kind of the rug may be pulled out from under us if we don't pay more attention to what's going on.
I think that's a really, I mean, that's that. It's an interesting take, and I do wonder for our listeners. You know, even me, I'm thinking about, you know, how am I worse off now than I was a year ago? And you know, it may not be me personally, but if I lived in Saskatchewan and I had a trans child, then yes, I am worse off now than I was a year ago, because regardless of what my child would want, they can be outed at school, and that is not the case that it was 6 months ago. And I think that where, you know, the legislation is happening, it is rolling out.
With every successive leadership election that we've had in the Conservative Party, the social conservatives have really been flexing their muscles. So now, you know, today we have the federal Conservative leader, Pierre Poilievre, who, you know, I want to make clear, has been very clear that he's not interested in reopening the abortion debate. However, he has been very willing to kind of send these signals that he has the social conservatives on side, which kind of brings us to the second part of your question, which is how does this compare to the abortion issue? So, really, the abortion issue has always been a bit of a helpful tool to the Liberal Party, especially when it feels like it's slipping in the polls. So it'll try to beat the Conservatives over the head with the issue of abortion to gain votes. And that has been more or less successful, depending on the election. Like you said, in the mid 2010s, it was more successful than it was towards the end, the last few elections that we've had. But really, the difference here between the abortion issue and trans rights specifically is that abortion is widely accepted by the Canadian population. So, ever since the Morgenthaler decision that struck down the criminalization of abortion, Canadian public opinion writ large has been very in favor of allowing people who need it access to abortion services. And it's been, you know, that's been kind of the consensus, even among the centrist wing of the Conservative Party. Certainly, they don't want to reopen the debate, even if the social conservatives want to. With trans rights, on the other hand, the public support is much less entrenched. It's much less long-standing. So, trans rights in Canada really picked up steam in the mid-2000s when we started seeing anti-discrimination legislation add the mentions of gender identity and gender expression as prohibited grounds of discrimination. So sexual orientation had been protected in the 90s, really. That's when case law really recognized sexual orientation as a protected ground under the Charter's equality rights. But trans rights took a little bit longer to develop. And so they haven't gotten internalized by Canadians as being as much of a Canadian value. So when you look at public opinion for same-sex marriage, for example, the vast majority of Canadians are in favor of it. But then when you look at, for example, right now, the issue of trans inclusion in schools or trans affirmative school policies, public opinion is not at the same level at all. And so I think conservatives are sensing that even if it may, well, it remains to be seen if federally it'll be a winning subject next election. But conservatives are willing to bet their chances on trying a new strategy out that may please their social conservative partners.
You know, that's what I was thinking. I was wondering if parental rights, which is how it's been framed in the conservative dialogue, is, you know, not only just a dog whistle to that social conservative base, but also, and I hate to say it, a softer target, you know, an easier target. You know, trans kids are maybe, I mean, it's in terms of just numbers of Canadians, 1 in 100 people are trans-ish, according to the census, give or take. And when we think about kids, that's an even smaller percentage. So it is a tiny number of people who are actually impacted, and able to make it personal. But yeah, maybe they've gone for a smaller target, a softer target. But I'm not convinced that going for and channeling that social conservative progress and aiming at trans kids is really the solution. And there seems to be some evidence indicating that perhaps this isn't the electoral win, the vote getter that that social conservatives seem to think that it is. I'm looking at the recent provincial election in Manitoba, where parental rights was really on the ballot between the choice between the Conservative Party there and I think it was the NDP. And then likewise in the UK, almost every by-election in Britain in the last year, the Conservatives have robustly lost by significant swings. And trans rights has been right at the forefront of the political dialogue in the UK. So it seems maybe we're just starting to get an inkling now that this isn't going to work. But is that fast enough? Is electoral change, electoral consequences fast enough, or are we still losing out in the meantime? And I'm referring here to the use of the notwithstanding clause and kind of coming back to your core piece. You know, what do you think? Do you think that, you know, will the will of the people win out, and will that be quick enough?
I'm certainly hopeful. It's definitely true that there are some signs that the parental rights agenda may not be as potent as the Conservatives are hoping. I want to preface this with the fact that there are public opinion polls out there that show that there actually are quite high levels of support for arguments around parental rights. I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but something off the top of my head was something like 65 to 70% of respondents, Canadian respondents in a survey, agreed with the statement that parental rights are being undermined and that parents should have more say over the decisions of their children to be referred to by a different set of name or pronouns. So I think we shouldn't underestimate the potential that the parental rights argument has. If only to better hone queer and trans activists' arguments against that, because there is a great argument to be made, for example, about parents of trans youth. Where are their parental rights? But I digress. So I think we're definitely seeing certain jurisdictions fail on the argument with trans rights. I think the caveat with that is also that parental rights or attacking trans rights have sometimes been used by conservative politicians and parties who are already on the way out. So your example of the Conservative Party in the UK, who has been there, who's been in place for quite a number of years and who's seen a lot of drama and not always the best news coverage of it. I think that they may have been trying to use trans rights as a lightning rod, and it just wasn't sufficient to dig them out of their hole. But certainly you're seeing, for example, in Saskatchewan, where the notwithstanding clause was used, the public really, there is a strong level of support for that measure. In New Brunswick as well, where this type of bill originated, there is considerable levels of public support, so much so that the premier of New Brunswick, who is the one who introduced this type of policy in the first place, felt confident enough to threaten a new election. He basically called the bluff of his more moderate members in caucus and said, "Oh, you don't think this is a winning issue? I think it is. I'm ready to call an election if you want to test this out." So I think it remains to be seen exactly how powerful it is as an argument to convince voters. But certainly the concerning part is less the argument that's being presented, though that is, of course, concerning, but it's more so the processes that we're willing to follow to achieve, to implement that argument. So the use of the notwithstanding clause itself was very controversial in the past. So conservative governments across different provinces and even federally have been very, very reticent to use the notwithstanding clause because they know it's going to... It either indirectly implies or overtly acknowledges that it is trampling on rights. Like, that's the whole point of using the notwithstanding clause, is that you're saying this legislation is going to operate notwithstanding a set of rights. That used to carry heavy political consequence. It was very rarely invoked. And now you're seeing, to be honest, conservative governments, because we're not seeing left-wing like NDP or centrist liberal governments use it. It's very much a center-right policy plank that they've been willing to use on a number of issues. So we saw, of course, Quebec, which has been the province that has used the clause the most in history for cultural and linguistic reasons as well. But even in Ontario, with Doug Ford, who is willing to use it, there are signs that the social landscape or the political landscape that had prevented politicians from using the notwithstanding clause is shifting, and it seems that the public is at the very least becoming less distressed with its use, if not, not opposing it entirely. So there is certainly a lot of work to be done to make sure that the rights that we have gained don't go back to a political argument when it has been settled case law for quite some time now.
I mean, I think your reference to settled case law reminds me of the recent overturning of Roe v. Wade in the States. You know, something that people thought was concrete in the foundation they stood on will not move, just got toppled over in the US. It's interesting because I've been recently doing my citizenship test and just waiting for the oath ceremony. But as part of that whole process, you know, one of the things that it keeps, circling back to is Canada is founded, founded on God and the rule of law. And it seems like, I mean, God, I'm like, I understand the history there, but I'll leave the radical reverend to flesh that out. But the rule of law piece, I think, is truly foundational, going back to the Magna Carta, to the whole underpinning. But the notwithstanding clause is, it's not a get out of jail free card, it's a get out of courts free card. You know, how is it that conservative premiers and the Saskatchewan Party are able to just run roughshod over the courts? Have they been made toothless by this?
That's a great question. So, to get a proper understanding of the notwithstanding clause, I think it's important to understand how it came to be in the first place. So, when Pierre Trudeau Senior was pushing for the repatriation of co the Constitution in the 1980s, which would lead up to the adoption of the Canadian Charter in 1982, he was really the one pushing for a set of entrenched rights that were enforceable by the courts. So prior to the Charter, Canada had what we call the Bill of Rights, which was a bill recognizing broadly similar rights as the Charter does. However, that one was enforceable by Parliament, which meant that if Parliament wanted to contravene it, there was really no one that could tell them they couldn't. And so Trudeau Senior was very adamant that the courts had to be the arbiters, so that way politicians could not, just supersede them willy-nilly. And the conservative premiers, or many premiers, not just conservatives, but especially conservative premiers at the time, were very reticent to allow what they saw as parliamentary supremacy kind of wither away. So the agreement that they had come to for the provincial premiers to agree to the charter was that they would insert the notwithstanding clause, which would allow them to abrogate certain parts of the charter for a period of 5 years. So I think that's important to note. The reason why we chose 5 years is because that's typically an election cycle. So the thinking goes, if a government uses a notwithstanding clause and it is actually very unpopular, by the next election they'll get kicked out and then it'll reset and then the rights will be restored. And also, the other thing to note is that when the notwithstanding clause was created, it was never intended to be used preemptively. It was always used as a mechanism of dialogue, is what we call it. So basically, Parliament establishes a law. The courts may say it's unconstitutional. This has to be changed. It goes back to Parliament. The Parliament decides whether the court decision stands or whether it wants to reassert its supremacy by using the notwithstanding clause. And so basically, yeah, we've had this mechanism that was really not anticipated to be used very much. It was supposed to be kind of a last resort type of thing. And now we're seeing today, really, it's becoming almost commonplace. It's becoming an issue that is not only reserved for these big, crucial debates that a parliament feels is necessary to weigh in on, but it's also on issues that are just a bit more mundane, if I can use that. Obviously, it depends who you ask, but for example, in the Toronto municipal election, Doug Ford had used the notwithstanding clause to prevent judicial challenges from his decision to redraw the boundaries of the of the municipal ridings in the city. And so, yeah, it just basically, this used to be a very charged tool. And today that just seems to be going away. It seems like politicians, especially conservative politicians, are not bound by the same rules that were established when the notwithstanding clause was introduced.
I mean, it's a concerning moment in history that we are in, especially folks who rely on the protections of the Charter, folks who are maybe in the opposing side of social conservatives. Heaven forbid that be the case. But, you know, it is, you know, I don't want to be all doom and gloom, and we try not to be. But realistically, I don't know that many political pundits out there who are not predicting the end of the Liberal regime, you know, in terms of the very likely electoral defeat in the next election. I will be floored if they aren't defeated, and then Pierre Poilievre will step in, most likely with current opinion polls sort of where they are, in that stead. You know, is this going to be, if conservative premiers are already using notwithstanding willy-nilly, is that a concern with the potential of a conservative federal government, and whether or not things will continue to be used, though this clause continue used, but at the federal level?
I'd say it's certainly a worrying possibility. So I want to preface this by saying the notwithstanding clause has never been invoked federally, certainly not by the Liberals, who are very pro-charter, but neither by the conservatives. No government federally has introduced a notwithstanding clause to trample over rights. That's not to say that it couldn't or wouldn't happen. I think, again, referring back to how honestly popular, or at the very least less controversial, the decision to invoke the notwithstanding clause is in Quebec, in Ontario, Saskatchewan now. And I think certainly you could make the case for New Brunswick, which may be interested, and even Alberta in certain cases. I think there's a very real possibility that if the federal conservatives felt that they had more to gain politically by invoking the notwithstanding clause, I think they would at the very least certainly consider it. Again, I want to make clear that there has been no indication so far that they will. They haven't talked about this. But it's not to say that it couldn't happen. I would like to think that the next federal election will be a change election and not truly an intentional election. So by that, I mean, I think people are more interested in voting out Justin Trudeau than they are voting in Pierre Poilievre. The result will be the same, which is likely a conservative majority. But I think that the intentions that voters ascribe to their choice is very important as well, which means that if the federal leader did overplay his hand and did invoke the notwithstanding clause, that may be a bridge too far for a lot of voters who just cast their ballot for the conservatives simply because they didn't want the Liberals to be in, but they weren't necessarily ready to endorse a wholesale dismantling of queer and trans rights.
I think you're absolutely spot on. I have been I'm in Orleans, which, you know, bleeds red, literally. You know, it is a Liberal stronghold. And I've talked to a lot of young folks, early 20s, and they have every intention of voting conservative. Young folks who I would never have guessed would have voted conservative. And it seems like there is that paradigm shift happening, that people are tired with the government in power. As far as I'm aware, in parliamentary democracies, no one has ever survived more than three terms. And so it is truly exceptional. And yeah, the sands are shifting, but hopefully the sands of law and order don't shift with it. Hopefully we can rest our feet on the concrete foundations of our charter, constitutional rights, and social norms. And fingers crossed, some of those social norms will survive a little bit longer than this particular government. Thank you so much, Francesco, for joining me. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you about this. And hopefully we'll have you on the show as further news and politics develop.
I would love that. Hopefully more cheery stuff to discuss next time, but I would love that.
Absolutely. All right. We'll be back just after this. That was C'était Seulement Romantique by Côte de Paraître. And folks will have to Google that to make sure I've pronounced it correctly. And we have time for maybe one last story. Now, this one, Sebastian, I've been thinking about the Roman Empire.
Well, I mean, I think about the Roman Empire all the time.
I mean, I think that's weird. It baffles me how often men think about it. But I want you to talk about that meme.
Fascinated by
particular.
Garum. It is fish that is put into a pot to rot for 6 months, and it was Rome's favorite ingredient. That's fascinating. But anyway, sorry, go on.
We're not here to talk about garum or the Roman Empire. I'm talking about very specifically Elagabalus. Elagabalus? Elagabalus, Elagabalus. Mm-hmm. Now, the North Hertfordshire Museum in England. Mm-hmm. So you can already tell this is a small museum in a pretty small place.
Yes.
They have decided, out of politeness, that was a decision made, out of politeness, they will now be referring to the Emperor Elagabalus. I'm sorry for pronouncing this ancient emperor's name, with she, her pronouns.
Okay.
The reason
women were not allowed to be emperors in Rome, they weren't even allowed to govern or hold Senate positions. But yes, okay.
Now, the reason being is because contemporary texts from the time and chroniclers by the Roman historian Cassius Dio specifically.
Okay.
Quote the Roman Emperor, I'm just going to refer to them as the Roman Emperor from now on, as saying, among many other things, call me not Lord, for I Am a Lady, okay. which I feel like is pretty on the nose. And this is apparently multiple times they were referred to as a wife, mistress, and queen, mm-hmm. Specifically asked to be identified using the female versions of the time. And this museum in Hertfordshire has decided that the polite thing to do thousands of years later is to actually use milady okay. instead of milord for this particular emperor. And it's caused, understandably, a bit of a kerfuffle. So a whole bunch of new people are thinking about that particular Roman emperor.
Yeah, but it's historically foolish because there are many Roman emperors who are referred to as women at the time, and that's what you refer to a Roman emperor when they consistently lose in battle. It was considered effeminate to be a bad warrior, and this Roman emperor in particular, or multiple Roman emperors really, because they were more focused on diplomacy and trade and less so on conquest and expanding the borders, were openly called women in their time. And some of them were like, well, fine, I'm a woman, I don't care, you know, like, whatever, call me what you want, I'm still the emperor, I'm still more powerful than you, go stick it, you know. And I'm not sure that this is a good instance of a historical rereading of a man actually being a trans woman, because, you know,
but is it a historical rereading, or is it maybe we finally listened? You know, when the emperor is saying, I am not a lord, I am a lady, it doesn't get a hugely more clear cut than that.
The Senate would have ejected him if he was a trans woman. Like, the context matters.
We're not going to settle Roman history today.
Yeah.
And we've got a whole lot more of you thinking about the Roman Empire than were before. We're going to be playing out with Feel Like Home by Roxanne Bruno. All of our songs this week were in French. I have been Luke Smith.
And I have been Aqueduct Lover Sebastian. And thank you for listening. You make me
like music or do you like technology? Or do you like talking to people? CGSF Radio is the place for you. Here at CGSF, the opportunities are endless. You can interview artists and bands, speak up for what you believe in, or even host your own show and tons more. To find out more information, visit cgsf.ca.
Oh boy, it's 5 o'clock.